Skid Row in Los Angeles has been described as an almost unbelievable landscape of hope and despair. It represents the largest outdoor houseless community in the country. In the 2007 documentary Skid Row, hip-hop artist Pross Michaels from the Fugees claimed that the area had the highest concentration of parolees, the highest concentration of service providers, the highest infant mortality rate, and the highest suicide rate in the city. I personally cannot impress on you enough about the size and scale of this place. In 2014, LA Weekly wrote, "As shocking as it is to look upon the rows and rows of makeshift encampments and thousands of roving, hopeless people, perhaps even more shocking is this. Los Angeles is the last major American city with a single district of anything approaching this magnitude of homelessness and extreme poverty." Now, since then, the situation has only gotten worse. And just a few blocks away in downtown Los Angeles, for the last several years, waves and waves of capital, mega projects, and new residents had been pouring into what is now called DTLA, downtown LA. And if anyone who's followed this podcast or this issue or seen our film Priced Out, you know that new investment coming into an area sometimes seems like a really good thing. But over the long haul, very rare that local residents see any benefit from that new investment. So what does this mean to Skid Row, a community that provides vital services, but is also overwhelmed by the social problems it faces? And I'm very, very proud and happy to have John Malpede here to talk about this issue. He's a highly acclaimed artist and artistic and theatrical director. He's been working with poverty-impacted communities for over three decades. He's received countless awards and fellowships for his work, including New York Dance Theater's Workshops Bessie Creation Award, San Francisco Art Institute's Adeline Kent Award, LA Theater Alliance Ovation Award. He taught at my old school, Tisch, at NYU. And in 1985, he founded the Los Angeles Poverty Department, the first performing artist group in the nation that worked primarily with homeless and formerly homeless people. He's the director there, and he's also the curator at the Skid Row History Museum and Archive. And they look at issues, a number of issues, including gentrification. John, thanks so much for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your work over the years with both the museum and with the L.A. Poverty Department?
Well, yeah, I mean, the L.A. Poverty Department I was still living in New York. I got involved with some activists who were working in Skid Row around the time of the Olympics, when there were a lot of police sweeps of the streets in order to make things happy for visitors. I felt that the community work that was going on, which was a conjunction of mainly people out of the Catholic Worker and clients who people who used the Catholic Worker services at the community, we had a really smart approach for fighting for the rights of people who lived there, whether they were housed or unhoused, and I got involved in that. And within a year, I ended up moving out there to do that full time, and then started this performance workshop, because in New York I was known as a performance artist, and the idea was to make community on Skid Row and get the real deal out to Normalville, which meant tell the story of what was going on from the point of view of people who lived there.
And what does the Skid Row Museum do?
You know, the displacement narrative is that Skid Row is a no man's land of transients, and that there's no community there. So many years ago, we did a project called Is There History on Skid Row? And from that, we tried to do a public art work project that sort of like the Hollywood work, A Walk of Stars, only acknowledging people who had lived and worked in the community had done stuff. And that predictably ran into huge political antagonism from the business community and from the people that worked for them at City Hall. And so that, you know, didn't happen as an inside sidewalk thing, because faces of activists would have shown up at places where they weren't wanted. And so we decided instead we put walls around our museum and located it on the forefront of gentrification,
mm-hmm.
to address, really look at both the history of the community and how it's resisted gentrification over the years.
I want to talk about that history for sure. I was there. I just want to like get to where it is right now, and then back up into the history. So I know I've only been there once. It was 2003, and it was really just like literally shocking to me. My body was shocked. It was tensed to come upon this area in the documentary Skid Row. They said that within a 5-block area, there was 40,000 people that had come through that in 1 year. I saw what seemed to be hundreds of people just on the streets, lining blocks and blocks of sidewalks. And what is it like today?
I think today there are about 3,000 people living on the street in Skid Row, and about, you know, at least 15,000 people who live indoors. Most, and two-thirds of those are probably permanent residents, so a lot of those people have lived 5, 10, 20 years, and other people are in a smaller part are in transitional programs, and that's where a lot of the transitional programs are. And as you mentioned from the Fuji documentary, most people coming out of state prisons and coming to L.A. end up in Skid Row, and that's because that's where there are reentry programs. That's where there's available hotel and shelter space. So it continues to be a resource, because that's where the services exist. You know, while there are 3,000 people living on the street in Skid Row, there are something like 30,000 people or more living on the streets of the city. And most of those people, encampments have spread. They're pretty much everywhere in the city. And most of those people are completely on their own, meaning there are no services at all near where those people are.
Right, and we talked earlier, and you were saying that, you know, since, you know, over the last decade, the problem has gotten so much worse. There were more people down in Skid Row, but also the homeless encampments and houseless communities all over the city. And you were just talking about an Echo Park, which is a rapidly gentrifying area, that there's kind of a camp there that gets bigger. I mean, it's the same situation in Portland. The scale is not nearly as dramatic, but there are houseless communities now in almost every sector of the city. But you were saying the distinction is that at Skid Row, people can get some services that they need, whether that's, I'm assuming, like drug recovery, medical services, and they can get shelter in Skid Row. There are SROs, which single room occupancy hotels, and shelters. So there are things for them, and the majority of people on Skid Row do have places to live. They're not on the sidewalk, right?
Well, there's still 3,000 people on the sidewalk, and I think, you know, everything is pretty much, you know, quite full.
Mm-hmm.
But, and one of the issues in Skid Row is that there's a desire within Skid Row to build more affordable housing there, but the rest of downtown, the gentrifying part of town, says we've done enough, meaning downtown, and they resist any further building of facilities or locating of services.
there is so much money going in to downtown LA. I mean, it seems like there's billions of dollars in investment, whether that's between, you know, sports stadiums, luxury hotels, and museums. I mean, the amount of investment is really unbelievable, especially if you live in Little Portland, Oregon. You know, LA like drops more money out of its coat pocket than Portland ever dreams to have for these types of things. But tell me a little bit more about just how did Skid Row come into existence? There was a time in the country when every city, every downtown had a Skid Row. I myself, in the early 90s, before I became a gentrifier, before I bought a house, I don't sell houses, but I just bought one in a poor community. I lived on Skid Row in Seattle, and Skid Row in Seattle called itself the original Skid Row because they used to skid logs down Yesler Street to the mills out the waterfront. I lived right there at the bottom of the hill. And, you know, it was a rough area, sort of. It wasn't really, it's nothing compared to Skid Row in Los Angeles. Skid Row in Los Angeles persists. So how did it come about?
As you said, the name comes out of Seattle, and basically, you know, wherever there was an opportunity for day laborers, whether it be unloading boxcars or sliding logs, people would congregate, and there'd be short-stay hotels that were built around there. And sometimes missions and stuff like that. And so it's for itinerant workers, that housing. And then, in most places, those areas were built over and the population dispersed, or at least, I would say colonized under more affluent forces. And, in Skid Row, you know, if you're familiar with L.A., there's Bunker Hill, which is what you see in car commercials and stuff like that, all the original high-rise skyline, which is now expanded geographically. But it was on top of Bunker Hill, which had been, previously a low-income residential community with apartments and boarding houses. It was under urban renewal. It was declared a blighted area, and the entire hilltop, if you were from Kentucky, you would say it was mountaintop removal, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was transferred from residential to corporate, the entire landscape. And on the success, on the quotation mark success of that, there was another business-generated plan called the Silver Book Plan. It proposed what to do with the rest of downtown, which included what to do with Skid Row, and basically it was to reduce it to one block and build upscale developments of various kinds on all the rest of it.
I also heard that, in Skid Row, the documentary, they said that the railroad terminated, that was kind of the last stop for the railroad, and so that, you know, hobos and folks who were kind of itinerant workers or, you know, traveling around, they would also congregate there. So, like, from its very early days, it had sort of a scrappy sort of personality.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, the hotels were there, but, yeah, it was because the railroad ended there. Again, the Catholic Worker and Legal Aid Foundation and something called the Community Design Center, they came up with an alternative plan. And they presented it, and basically their plan said, let's save this low-income housing, all these hotels that were built for the itinerant workers in this 50-block square area, because, number one, it's a lot cheaper than building housing, for low-income, super low-income housing, I mean, extremely low-income housing. And number two, if you demolish it, the people in this neighborhood are going to go somewhere else, like your neighborhood. So it was an idealistic plan that also scared the hell out of people who didn't, you know, really give a damn about low-income people, only that they didn't want them around.
Mm-hmm.
So so this coalition of the idealistic and the cynical came up with the solution of saving the housing in this 50-square-block area, which, as I said, didn't happen in any other city, and that's why there are no others. Why, like that LA Weekly article called LA Skid Row, the last Skid Row. All the others have, you know, if you go to New York, the Bowery is full of multiplexes and luxury hotels fancy this and fancy that. So,
and Skid Row in Seattle is all is becoming, you know, kind of like a high-end retail area as well. Yeah. I mean, Paul Allen, Vulcan Industries, and all those guys are kind of slowly, you know, putting high-rise office buildings in, you know, over the shoulder of old Skid Row.
There's been, you know, obviously because Skid Row is just it's just east of the you know, the rest of downtown. There's been a continuous ever since that time. There's been one plan after another to try and figure out how to get a hold of this real estate and you know, and realize the value in the land and while disregarding the human value that's there now.
The containment policy, it's literally called containment, right? Which is, you know, deliberately concentrating social services in an area. In Skid Row, the dock, they said the intention was that people would avail themselves of a centralized area of services and then move on. But, you know, people don't necessarily have the ability to move on. And over time, they stay there.
Yeah, or at least stay in that area. If everything that they allegedly needed was in that area, then they wouldn't.
And I love this combination of the compassionate and the cynical, like joined forces.
So they ended up first they gave money to some of the owners of the hotels, and suddenly, and they realized quickly that money just disappeared. And so they ended up creating a nonprofit and buying a lot of the hotels. Subsequently, another nonprofit was created by activists in the area that bought up more hotels. So now I think they're over 60 hotels, and they were able to build some others. There are over 60 hotels that are in the hands of nonprofits that, you know, provide housing that's decent. And
'70s, '50s, '60s, '70s, I think it's fair to say it was kind of a classic American downtown in a classic sprawl city like a Houston or an Atlanta, where, you know, the residents had just scattered to the winds, and so had the businesses had left. There were some corporate holdouts who occupied, you know, citadels in the sky, fortified against any real interaction with people on the ground. And it was sort of like a combination of remaining poor communities or working class communities, abandoned areas, and this like sterile, corporatized, privatized space. Not a place that the majority of the metropolitan area wanted to spend time in. And then about 10 years ago, you really started to see a pickup of investment. You know, can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Actually, one thing that did that was the adaptive reuse ordinance, which came in around 1999, I think, something like that, which allowed commercial spaces, vacant commercial spaces, to be transformed into, quote, loft living. And so that, you know, that brought in, that had a lot to do with bringing in a residential neighborhood and, the desire of creating a sort of an entertainment district with, you know, top-heavy with bars and restaurants. A friend of mine said recently, you know, downtown LA is probably the most mixed income part of the city, even though when they did the adaptive reuse ordinance, none of those buildings were, they didn't have any thought of turning some of those vacant buildings downtown into housing for low income or homeless people. You know, that was not part of their equation at all. But by bringing in a more affluent group of people, suddenly there is a mixed income.
LA is, you know, its own beast, its own entity, and that gentrification is sort of, it's very decentralized, and sort of neighborhoods all across the city are gentrifying at simultaneously to downtown. There's no real relationship there between the connections. But the adaptive reuse thing, the loft living, is like so common to so many of these gentrification developments?
The ordinance was first applicable to downtown and then subsequently to other places. And there's a similar rezoning effort going on right now.
Right.
They're rewriting the zoning code, which is something that had just been a bunch of post-it notes over the last, since the 40s, I guess. So they're, quote, rationalizing the code. But as a result, they're writing new community plans. And this, again, one of the first ones they're realizing is the one in downtown. So again, it's a current threat to the neighborhood.
Tell me, this seems to be like the big existential threat, in that you have this investment rolling through downtown, and the next big sort of quote unquote undervalued opportunity zone is essentially the industrial properties that exist in Skid Row. You know, Skid Row has these housing, SROs, these hotels where people in need live, but there's also some industrial sites. But there's not a lot of other market rate rental or home ownership sites. So markets, investors are looking at, if we can convert these industrial areas, we can make some money. And is that correct?
Fish packing industry is actually the main industry down there, but there's also a lot of land banking going on. There are a lot of vacant properties that have been for a long time. Only a few market rate loft buildings that are in the area. Nothing. They haven't been able to build anything there, but that would all change under the proposed rezoning. And on the east side of Skid Row, down by the LA River, it was for many years known as the Artist District, and now, of course, it's the Artist District in caps, but all the artists have been removed, and condos and things have gone into that area. So Skid Row stands between those two gentrified parts of downtown, and the goal of the new zoning seems to be, to link those two via upscaling. Skid Row, the residential population is all low income. The neighborhood has been able to, really activate on its own behalf. That's the only reason it's there, like I said earlier, because of various fights that have kept it from being disappeared. Like right after the adaptive reuse ordinance happened, just outside of Skid Row on Main Street, there were a lot of residential hotel conversions. And people were displaced. People in Skid Row organized, and they got a citywide hotel moratorium enacted. So because the neighborhood has had, sort of a residential part of the neighborhood, and the people working with the residents have had sort of a distinct vision of what's wanted and needed, they've been able to successfully advocate for that. But if the entire area is overlaid with development, will be that much harder to for that voice to be heard.
What is the current state of resisting this this rezone?
Well, I mean, the neighborhood has successfully fought a number of individual projects. And right now, we entered into a dialogue with the planning department that has actually been over the last year, because we sort of got ahead of the curve on this. And so that's resulted in significant attention from the planning department and understanding of the community wants and some alteration of the plan. But, the planning department works for the city council and the mayor, so the serious heavy lifting when the next iteration of the plan comes out and afterwards. There's a coalition called the Skid Row Now 2040 Coalition that's developing, that we're a part of, that's developing its own neighborhood plan. We're planning to continue to push for what we see as a more equitable solution that respects the people and the culture that exists.
in Portland, we're beginning to see the city council begin to get reshaped by the housing crisis, meaning that people, voters have been organized or responding to, you know, the daily headlines, the protests in the street over housing crisis. And you know, at least one standing city council has been knocked out. And the current slate of people running for the open seat here in November are all, you know, sort of housing first is their platform. Are you seeing that kind of movement in LA politics as well?
I would say no. Mm. It hasn't happened.
Do you feel you have any other leverage, or that the community there, resistance, is this the resistance community or other institutions and allies, do they see other leverage that they can get? I know there was a big bond that was passed a couple of years back that was supposed to help fund services for houseless communities.
For homeless communities?
Yeah.
In the last year and a half, Proposition H passed. One was to provide services, outreach services and services in support of hotels and for supportive housing. And the other was to create supportive housing over 10 years. So that's something that's going on now. And there's been a lot of resistance to creating the housing because NIMBYism and various, you know, people who voted for the bond measure don't want it to go into the housing to actually go into their neighborhood. So that's an ongoing thing that people are wrestling with. And there are a number of groups that are you know, fighting when various council people don't want to support people who don't want to have any housing going into their neighborhood. You know, so that's an ongoing thing. And the big concern among many of us is, you know, is the money actually going to be spent?
Well, That's about all the time we have. John, is there something that you can, something else you want to say, but also like a direction you would want listeners to take, things that you'd want them to get plugged into if they want to help with this issue or learn more?
I mentioned the Skid Row Now 2040 plan regarding the future of Skid Row. Mm-hmm. Is one thing I don't know. That's one thing. The ongoing fight about what's going to happen with H and HHH, and earlier in the week, the mayor proposed, that each council district set up a temporary shelter. I guess trying to get around the fight over who doesn't want it in their neighborhood. But I'm not sure that wasn't anywhere near adequate. I can tell you that. Either. Mm. So basically, there's a homeless crisis. The local government still hasn't come up with an adequate response.
Well, we will include links to your organizations and definitely to those campaigns. And it's a tough situation. LA is so expensive all over the place. We hope to cover more of the neighborhoods. Boyle Heights is right adjacent to to downtown LA, and that's a big flashpoint. But I wish you the best of luck. You know, in Portland, it got to the point where just there was no affordable places left, and only at that point did residents sort of push back and begin to change things at city council. I hope it doesn't come to that in LA, but just wish you the best of luck, sir. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thanks so much, Cornelius.